طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of a Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. Today we sit down with Nidal Al-Azraq, Executive Director of the organization One for Three, to discuss his work in the Aida refugee camp in Bethlehem. Although he now resides in the Boston area, Nidal grew up in the Aida camp and returns often to carry on his work with One for Three and visit his family. Here is our conversation with Nidal Al-Azraq. Nidal, you grew up in the Aida refugee camp Bethlehem, and many of your family still live there. And although you now live in the Boston area with your family, because of your deep roots in the Aida camp and your work as director of the organization One for Three, in many ways you still live there. Tell us a bit about your family growing up in Aida camp and your continuing relationship with the people there.
Yes, thanks, John. Yes, I still, a big part of me still live there, to the point where I just had a Zoom meeting with our team in Palestine this morning. And, I grew up in Aida refugee camp. I was born and raised in the Aida refugee camp. It's one of the three refugee camps in Bethlehem. It's a small camp. It's the size of it is about the size of one city block of New York City, and hosts around 4,500 refugees, and almost half of them are under the age of 18. Wow. So you're talking about a very geographically very small area for this number of people, and these people are all refugees. They came from 27 different villages in 1948 and in 1967. You know, in these two periods of time, in 48, when Israel was blessed, established as a result of it, a huge number of Palestinians were forced to leave their villages. And Aida camp is in Bethlehem area, so many of the refugees came from that part of 48, which is the southern part of Palestine. And in 1967, a new wave or another wave of refugees came from the surrounding area, like in Malha and other villages around Bethlehem, to settle in the city. And as you know, in the 1950-51, the United Nations stopped renting these pieces of lands from the native people of the city, which they are the Christians, and to establish these refugee camps where the refugees are settled now in the Bethlehem area. So just a bit more about Aida camp right now. I mean, it's really actually like Angela Davis, when she visited Palestine in 2008, she described it as an open-air prison. So if you look and Google Aida refugee camp, you can see it as surrounded by an 8-meter concrete wall from two sides, two military bases from one side. It's very heavily militarized around the camp, monitored. So the political situation there and the confrontations and the protests due to the Israeli army presence is always on the go. So me growing up in this camp with my entire family, which, you know, I'm the youngest of 11. So we are 8 brothers and 3 sisters. Mm. All right. So we're a medium-sized family. We're not big family, John. But yet, to grow up in this family, politically diverse family, in a place, so I witnessed, you know, the early 70s, 80s, 90s, Oslo period, the 2000 invasions and in-betweens, you know? So me as a kid growing up in this place, I really established a two different relationship with this place. One relationship, I don't really feel connected to the physical place as a refugee camp. And I say that because it's a refugee camp. We're refugees by the standards of the international laws based on the 1949 Nation Resolutions. I have the right to go back to my original village. So this is where I belong. Mm. You know, this is my right, and this is all my struggle as a Palestinian is to achieve this this right. So I don't really feel strong in relationship with the physical place as the camp, but I do feel very strongly attached and physically have a strong relationship with the people.
Yes.
Of Ada refugee camp, the memories and all the events that happened because. When you look at Ada refugee camp, most of the people who came from these villages, they knew each other before.
Mm-hmm.
Before 48, because they were like next to each other. So, so all these generations, the grandparents, the parents, their children, the grandchildren, grew up in this small place together. So, like, you know, we're socially, we're very connected, you know, and very bonded. You know, as sure. As a community, so I do respect this a lot, and this is one of the main reasons that I still work. Like 90% of my work and my effort and my energy is poured into refugee communities because I know the importance politically. I know the importance of the refugee camp. You know, the whole thing started with the refugee crisis when Israel was established.
Yeah.
Okay. And without finding a just solution for refugees, you cannot achieve any quote-unquote peace or anything, or any final solution, whatever that is, you know. So my relationship to Ida is still strong because not because I work or my projects are, or, you know, our projects are there, but also my entire family live in Ida refugee camp. My mother, my sisters, my brothers, my nieces, and my nephews, all live in, most of them live in either refugee camp. So, I am still attached to,
sure.
to that place.
Yeah. Tell us how you came to Boston. How did you end up here?
How did I end up here? Oh, man, you are triggering a lot of memories here. In 2002, you know, during the invasion of Ida refugee camp by the Israeli army, you know, Israel at that point brought, I think as they said, they named their operation, Military Operations Israel. So that operation in 2002 in March, they called it the knife and the butter.
Uh-huh.
Because the army occupied the Intercontinental Hotel and they used it as a base to attack the camp. So the soldiers were laying down in these 5-star hotel rooms shooting at us. So they brought 500 soldiers, 2 Apache helicopters, and a lot of tanks around the camp. And you know, before that time I used to work as an electrician, and I used to be a basketball player, and I used to work in restaurants and churches, in a lot of things. But during that invasion, when Israel invaded the camp with this number of army and machines, I was shot from air, from the Apache. I had 40% disability. Because the Apache, when they start firing randomly, a bullet hit the ground, a sharpen from the bullet hit the nerve that's responsible for the foot. So I have a foot drop now. and I'm going to live with it for the rest of my life. So my career as a basketball player, my career as an electrician is gone. Mm. Okay? So I joined, at that time, I was recruited by Laji Center, a youth organization at a refugee camp to come and start working with their youth. And at that moment, it was a self-discovery, you know, shifting from constructions, electricians, working all these things to being, you know, working with the community and for the community and with kids and youth. And at that time, running a large center with this incredible people, group of people in Ida, this professor or this PhD students came along to do to volunteer into the Ida refugee camp. Mm-hmm. At that time, we were working on a play called The Birds, which The Birds means the Palestinian collaborators who live in the Israeli prison, who usually trick Palestinian detainees into confessions. So we're running this play, educating the other youth people in Ida camp about it, and we're looking for somebody with a video camera. You know, Laji was back then poor, no money, no equipment. And a friend of ours said, oh, I have this friend who has a camera. And the next day she brought, now she's Professor Amal Bishara, she's my wife. She brought her to the camp to help us with the video the play that we were working on, and I worked as her assistant. Uh-huh. And year after year, she's doing her research, PhD research in Palestine, and working with her, so the relationship developed, and I ended up from Ida refugee camp coming to New York City.
Uh-huh.
So this is how I ended up in the U.S., and the rest is history, my friend.
Uh-huh. Okay, some of it's new to me. I didn't know about your injury. That's news to me.
Yeah, one of them.
Yeah, one of them. All right. And talk about how did you hook up with One for Three, and what are they all about? What is the organization trying to do?
Well, let's talk about. How did I end up with 143? At Laji Center, we established this media unit and trained these young people how to make videos and photographs to tell their story from their own narratives. And one of the young youth, now he grew to become the director of Laji Center. At that time, in 2011 or 12, made a video called Everyday Nakba about the water situation and water shortage in Ida refugee camp. And this video made it to the Boston Palestine Film Festival. It's a 10-minute long video. And there was screened there. Among the audience were faculties from Tufts University and the founders of 143. So they saw this movie, and they say, wow, that's very interesting. We would love to get involved and learn more about the water situation in Ida. So they did the research. They found out that Amal Bishara, her research is about Ida, and she's a professor at Tufts. They met her to find out that Nidal, her husband, is actually from Ida refugee camp and actually working with Laji Center. So we met. So this young kid, his movie is the reason, the main reason behind all of that.
Oh, really? Yeah.
His movie did not make it to the Boston Palestine Film Festival, and these people saw it. We wouldn't be talking about 143 this way right now. So we met, and here's an important part of the story, John. So when 143 came to me, they were working on water project in Africa, where they stopped at that time, and they said, we would love to work on the improving the water quality and quantity in Palestine, starting in Ida. We saw this movie, and I told them, well, people in Palestine are really, especially in refugee camps, are really frustrated and tired of international agencies and foundations coming to Palestine with their monies and their ideas to enforce them on the community, and use the communities as just do this and do that without really meeting and learning and educating themselves about the real situation and the real challenges on the grounds. And also without creating or leaving the space for the community to be involved in the step of thinking of the project, of running the projects and owning the projects and all of these things. So I told them, why didn't you guys come with me and let's go and spend a whole week in another refugee camp and live with the people, talk with Laji, the partners, but also learn about the situation and hear it directly from people. And they said, yes, sure enough, we went, a bunch of people from 143 and Tufts University Engineering School, to either refugee camp, and we met with everybody. We met with men, women, children, youth, a whole week living, talking, eating, socializing, living the whole situation to get the best idea about that. At the end, it was simple for 143 to ask the question is, okay, well, for anything to be successful, in our work, the community has to be involved as partners. And I'm using this term partners, John. It's not a selling point like many organizations. It's not a selling point for donors. When we say partners, we meant that partners in thinking together, in deciding together, in implementing the projects together. And this is what we do, our teams in the U.S. and in Palestine. We do travel, we think, we build, we do everything together. And the community at that time asked us, well, we have three challenges, or four, but let's start with three at that time. They said, we have a problem with water. We have a huge shortage of water, especially in the summer, and this is due to Israel control over water in the Area C in the West Bank. And that's really, it's since that time until now, the problem tripled in size. And I can talk about it later on how and why. So we need a problem. We need to increase the quantity of water, but we also don't know about the quality. We don't know what kind of water we're drinking in that. Again, they said, we don't have a clinic. We need some kind of a medical program. And they said, we have one kindergarten school in Idakab, which is in the basement of a mosque. Environmentally is really not suitable for kids. So this is the things, if you guys want to partner with us, don't work with us as you are a donor, we are recipients of a benefit. Work with us as partners. We as a community and partner, we need to be involved and engaged in the process of what we're doing together. And this proven to be one of the key elements of the success we have been having all these years, and the sustainability and the development of the project is the involvement of communities in the project and the ownership of the local communities of this project. So 143, to jump into another area of discussion, is really working on the issue of food, health and education. It's about house-based, like house-based gardening, community healthcare for chronically ill patients. We work on the training in medical skills for young people to lead these programs along with the water testing that we did, which is, it's related to the water shortage that I would love to talk about it at the end. When we talk, go deep talking about the politics of our work, you know, the food program that we included also related to, politically, to the lack of agricultural lands and the control of Israel over the agricultural lands in Area C. We started with the rooftop gardens and we shifted to now hydroponic, and right now we are in the process of building an aquaponic system, which is a fish system that feeds the plants. So 1-4-3 really working on the goal to provide holistic support to strengthen the communities we serve. And we will continue to focus on building capacity, partnering with local groups who are accountable to the people they serve, and developing long-term goals that, you know, based on deep discussions with these partners or communities.
And recently, you built a preschool, a new preschool within the camp. Tell us a bit about that, because I watched that from the beginning. It seemed to be a very cooperative venture and quite a success. But I'd love to have you tell us about the development of the school.
Oh, that's beautiful. I mean, this is one of the really beautiful projects that we did in Palestine. And I was lucky with a team from the U.S., like architects like Hubert Murray, the chief architects who worked in the school, to be there for the graduation.
Yeah.
This year, recently we came back from Palestine. The idea came when we met with our partners at LAGI and many people of the community. They said, look, there's a lot of private schools in Bethlehem. They do really unique education, but they are very expensive, extremely expensive for our kids. We cannot send our kids there. And this is an important stage of the child's life. For education, and they ask us, we should not get less quality of education than these than the other kids who live outside of the refugee camp. And this really personally put me and the director of LAGI in the spot of thinking about building and designing a school that really not compete with the private school in Bethlehem, but really the same or higher standards than them, because we believe that these kids in the refugee camp deserve to have this quality of education. And it was a long journey, and it was not an easy journey. When we bought the garages on the playground level, we traveled, me, Huberts, and other teams from 1-4-3 into the ground, and we stood in these garages, and other teachers came with us, like Catherine Hanna and other Beverly from Virginia, and these garages were empty, just concrete walls and columns. And we said, like, how on earth are we going to build a school here? You know, so we locked ourselves with a team from IDA for 5 days, every day from 8-9 a.m. till 4 or 5 p.m. every single day, to brainstorm about architectural designs, curriculums, models that we can carry here with us, and start writing the process. And almost like 5 or 6 days of rehearsing and workshopping the vision of the school, it became clear to us that we are going to build a new model. A school that is based on, you know, it's going to be English and Arabic. It's going to include special needs, which is the only school in Palestine that incorporates special needs, actually, right now. It's Al Yasmin Kindergarten, and it's going to be English and Arabic. It's going to involve all the programs that LAGI has. LAGI has music institutes, environmental units, water testing units, the library, the health units. All these projects are going to be incorporated in the curriculum of this preschool. And we thought about, from the beginning, of building a school that it is really going to be a community space, not only a school for the children, but a space for the community, not only for the mothers and the fathers of the children, but also the community has to really be involved in the process of building the school. We did a lot of fundraising. Many people in the U.S. and beyond, and in Palestine, contributed for the constructions of this school. And we finished the constructions, and we start hiring the teachers. We had great help from Palestinian professionals, such as Yamila Shanana, Khitam Idlibi, to work with our teachers for a whole year in training them on a new approach of working with kids who live in such a place. We need also to remember, John, we built this school maybe 50, 100 meters away from the Israeli military camp. We built this school in a place that's surrounded by walls and watchtowers and army. We built this school in a very tough, complicated space, a refugee camp. It was a big challenge for us. It was a big challenge for the teachers, for Laji, to not only protect it, you know, to make this school a safe place, a safe environment full of care, love, fun, great way of learning for both the kids and their families. And after all these years of doing the constructions, training the teachers, hiring, working, our team here every week will do the Zoom training with the teachers, following the process of teaching throughout the year, just to go and see the result during the graduation this year. It was just unbelievably amazing. It was also amazing talking to the community and to the parents, you know, about how they feel, what do they think of the first year. It was just the comments and the was very good. And it was really good also because the school built a big reputation in Palestine to the point where people from Jerusalem, from other areas, other villages, want to register their kids at the school. Yes, we don't have the capacity, so this puts us in a place right now to build a third classroom to accommodate more people into this beautiful, amazing system that we built. We still have a lot of challenges. We have a lot of kids who deserve this opportunity, but also who do have a lot of kids with special needs. You know, we only can incorporate a small number of special needs in this school. The demands are very high, so hopefully in a year we will be able to buy the new place and do the constructions of the new place and build the third classroom that we can accommodate an extra 20 to 25 kids. Right now we have 50 kids, so you're going to include another 25 kids. That's going to be like around 75 kids into this amazing system to prep them for the next stage in their education. But also we need to think about the extra benefits that came out of the school. When we did the constructions, all the labor came from Ida Camp. You know, the plumbers, the electricians, the materials. You're looking at the teachers who are operating the school, who have full-time job security in their life. And the third classroom will bring more of that. So we think about it as a holistic benefit for everybody.
That's quite a story. Say something about, a little bit more about the hypoponic project, I've seen pictures of it. Unfortunately, I haven't been over since it was developed, but just amazed at the success of those gardens, particularly when they came under assault this year. But say something about that project.
Yeah, this is a great project. Well, first we started with the rooftop gardens. We built a lot of rooftop gardens on the rooftop of the houses, and this is due to the lack of land. The camp is very crowded, as you know.
Yeah.
So you can practically cross half of the camp jumping from rooftop to another. This is how connected the houses are in other refugee camps. So there's no land left, especially after Israel built the wall around the camp. And so we left for the rooftop gardens, and food sovereignty and food security for people was major, but also to reconnect these refugees to the land, to the agriculture again, was an amazing step. So the rooftop gardens were and still very successful in other refugee camps. This is before the hydroponic. But in the summertime, Israel, due to the Israel control over water, the water will be off in other camp between 2 weeks to 6 weeks and even more. So these families will have to make the decision. Do I need to give the water I have to the plants or save it for drinking or cooking? So it's a problem in the summer for the rooftop garden and for, in fact, you know, the water shortage. And this pushed us to think about developing the model of agriculture based on the challenges we have in the refugee camp in the urban areas, which is the hydroponic system. Hydroponic system is a great system because it saves you, if it's run correctly, it could save you over 85% of water usage. A huge. And you can fit in very small area. For example, this unit is 55 square meter that has 2,500 plants right now. 2,500 plants sits in 55 square meter room, you know, and the production of the hydroponic 3 times higher than the traditional way of doing, like the soil, things like that. So it was a win-win. But one of the reasons why we built this unit, because we have the Health for Palestine program. So we have 135 patients with hypertension and diabetes from Ada refugee camp and Al-Azza refugee camp involved in the health program. And this project actually was built and dedicated to these families, where the patients will come and learn about this model, planting food, then themselves plant the food, and then at the end harvest it and have healthy food to help them with their diabetes and other diseases. So later on, we discovered that this hydroponic became like the best place for these patients, because it's a place where they can meet, socialize, talk. It's a green, beautiful place full of healthy food that they grow themselves and they harvest and take home. So it's a multi-level, multi-layers of benefits for this family on their health, on their mental health, food-wise, to the point where they start asking of taking it to their house, taking this system to their houses. So this is a big system to fit inside the house. And then we went and we start investigating or designing a micro hydroponic units. If you saw these towers in the middle of the units, each tower has 40 seedlings in it, and it was designed to fit the household. So far we distributed 50 systems, 50 families of these patients, and now they are operating in their houses, and they plant, some families plant leafy vegetables, some families planted cucumber and tomatoes, and then you can do anything in this system. It saves water, it saves a lot of things. Of course, you know, everybody has to go through training on how to run, how to test the water, how to make sure it's getting the right food for what, for plants, etc., etc. Because of the success of this project and the amount of produce we're getting out of it, right now, actually, based on the last fundraising we did, part of the money is going to build, to expand the unit and build 30 square meter more for aquaponic system. The aquaponic system is going to be a big tank full of fish, and the fish waste is going to be like feeding all the plants, and we're going to increase the number of seedlings to 4,500 plants. So you're talking about a really big, large quantity of food production is going to be giving to this family every 3 to 4 weeks. So the harvest is every 3 to 4 weeks. This is how fast hydroponic grows vegetable.
Okay, let's shift to the hard part, and that is what's going on over there. And several people, almost everyone that I know that's been over there, come back and talk about how things are getting worse, how it's so difficult under the occupation. And you said that also. Can you describe what you mean by that? What's happening?
Without going back to the history of the occupation,
yeah, no,
all these things, we can take it from when Trump was in power.
Yeah.
All right. Of course, while Trump was in power, we had another catastrophe in the world, which is the COVID. Israel always has a plan to move in the annexations and in the settlements and in the control and the fragmentations of the Palestinian lives everywhere, especially in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And during the Trump era, Israel really took advantage of him being in power to speed this process. And when I say speed this process, meaning like increase the number of settlements, increase the number of military bases in the West Bank, increase the number of control over agricultural land, intensify the arrests among young people. The house demolitions in Jerusalem went way, way up. The wars in Gaza, the siege. And when COVID came, you know, plus also, you know, during Trump time, him and Kushner, if you guys remember the deal of the century, came with a map. Mm-hmm. A vision for a Palestine state, which is not a state. It's a very confusing map. It was very confusing for people then. It's like there's no one Palestinian unit in this state. It's so fragmented. And COVID came, Israel start really implementing this plan, at the deal of the century and the map. Meaning, for example, if you go around Bethlehem area, and you go in a village like Al-Walaja village. It's like, you know, 5 minutes drive from Bethlehem. So it's going to be completely cut from Bethlehem, and there's going to be a tunnel for people communicating from this village to Bethlehem, and the roads will be for the settlers. So with this, what Israel did during Trump time and during COVID, they managed to fragment and cut every single Palestinian community from the other. And they did this through doing a lot of infrastructures, new tunnels, new settler roads, new infrastructure in and between these villages and these Palestinian areas in the West Bank. And with that, John and everyone, Palestinians lost control over a lot of agricultural lands. Mm-hmm. And lost control over a lot of water resources, more water resources, and lost control over a lot of areas in Area C and B. And this led to forced transfer a lot of communities over these areas, pushing them to go to Area B and Area A, making Area A very, very crowded. This made the West Bank, as West Bank, extremely fragmented and divided. It's impossible to connect any city with each other because you have the increased number of settlements and settler roads and checkpoints in these areas. And this resulted in having much less water than before. Because, you know, each time you increase the number of settlements and settlers, you take the water share from where? From the Palestinian water. Time you increase the settler and the settlements and the settler roads, you take agricultural lands from Palestinians, making Palestinians depending more and more on the Israeli products in Palestine. And this is another catastrophe for the Palestinian farmers, who really are struggling in every way struggling to have access to their lands and plant it and have a local produce being sold in the Palestinian markets. This brings a lot of dark future for Palestinians when they see all these process being done, you know, in the West Bank, and Israel announcing over and over there will not be a Palestine state, and we will never have allow the Palestinians to have their own states, etc., etc. And it is clear on the ground what they're doing. They're really dominating. There's no Area C anymore. This is part of Israel. Area C, and we know that Area C is 62% of the West Bank. Yeah. Area B is so fragmented, so shattered, you know, and Area A extremely, extremely crowded, OA overcrowded. And along with this political situation and along with COVID, the unemployment rate went way up. It's over 50% in refugee camps. The unemployment rate, the poverty, the incarceration among young people. The prisons are full of Palestinian prisoners, especially children. Lack of control over a lot of aspects of our life have pushed, by Israel, of course, have pushed Palestinians slowly losing the hope of having any future thing that belongs to them in Palestine. When you talk about the army activities in Palestine, for example, when I went into this visit in the refugee camp, it was a long trip, crossing that bridge from Jordan to the West Bank was not easy. And I arrived to my mom's house. I put my luggage on the veranda, on the floor. And I was on my way to greet her. And two tear gas canisters fall on us. And my mom is 84 years old, woman, cannot walk. So I had to carry her and rush inside the house. This is my first two meetings. I just arrived there. And after that, it's a completely mess of night incursions, arrests, shooting, etc., etc., etc. And now, one of the worst things, John, that Israel is using these places not only to arrest or to do house search for security, they're using them as a training ground. For example, when they bring any new units into the West Bank, they train these new units on the Palestinians. Because why go and build a training base for them? We have live objects to train them on. So they train them on shooting, invasions, house incursions, and 2, 3, 5 in the mornings, arrests, all of these things. So to look at Palestinian lives with all these challenges, socially, economically, politically, and knowing that it's going to get worse, it's not going to improve from now on. You just use imagination to see and think about how Palestinians feel and live their life.
And we're a large part of that problem.
Oh, big time. And it's visible there. It's not hidden.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, without the support of the United States, Israel can't do this. We just have a few minutes. What would you say to the American people in terms of what we can do? Do you think politically, or how do we make visible the Palestinian story, the Palestinian narrative, which Israel works so hard to censor in this country? We don't get the story, and we've got to change a lot of minds. Do you have any ideas about how we do that?
Well, you have been doing this work, John, for years, and many times we cross paths and work together on these issues. But me going to Palestine and see how much the U.S. is involved there is really disturbing.
Yeah.
Really disturbing. First, if you look at the U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, especially in Palestine, the Palestinians see the U.S. foreign policy through the soldier, the Israeli army. So when this Israeli soldier comes to their house in the middle of the night to arrest and shoot and things like that, it's fully equipped with the U.S.-made weapons. And it's written on them, made in USA. From a tear gas canisters, it will be written on it, the name and the telephone number and the address of the factory in Pennsylvania. To the M16 is written on it, U.S. made. To the fully gear of this. So this is the U.S. foreign policy. This is how Palestinians view the U.S. foreign policy. It's through the Israeli army, through the occupation into their life. But also looking at the violation that Israel is doing and kicking into the wall the international laws and the human rights obligations under the U.S. blessing, in terms of settlement buildings, in terms of incarcerations, in terms of the occupation itself, make Palestinians think of the U.S. as a whole, the U.S. as a foreign policy is just like not only a double standard, it's completely in Israel's benefits. One more thing recently happened, the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh.
Oh, yeah.
She's an American citizen, a Palestinian-American citizen. And everybody, it was proven by a lot of people, American agencies, Israeli human rights, everybody, is that a soldier shot this journalist. Now the U.S. demanded to have the bullet. And in less than an hour, they decided that the bullets do damage to prove that Israel is responsible for the killing of this icon, this journalist. So as a U.S. government, you keep over and over sending the message to the Palestinians that we are completely in the side of the occupiers and you really don't matter. Even if you are a citizen, an American citizen, but because you're a Palestinian, you do not matter. These policies, that's really put the Palestinian in the area that they're left. They're pretty much left alone in this battle. I would say, working all these years with incredible groups in the U.S., I would say that the American people, the ones who believe in justice, the ones who believe in the cause, in the Palestinian cause as well, is bonding and collaborating and partnering and working on changing the U.S. foreign policy, the U.S. Political system in regards to Israel-Palestine. This is the most helpful way for us. Because without pressure, without changing the attitude, the political approach, the U.S. political approach to Israel-Palestine, things won't change. The Palestinians have their own responsibility to struggle on the ground against the occupation in any means. But as Americans, when I look at our tax dollars, our reputations, our everything in the Middle East, not only in Palestine. You go to look at Yemen. Look at the U.S. help to the Saudis in Yemen. Look at this and that. But if we're talking about Palestine, either we like it or not, as individuals, we are deeply involved in contributing to the suffering of the Palestinians, as Americans. Palestinians there. So our responsibility is not only to educate our politicians, it's to force them to confront the truth about what's going on the ground and work in changing. That is what I think is where most of our friends and solidarity, they should concentrate their energy, is to really not only pressure, keep going after these politicians until they change.
Oh, well said, Nadal. Well said. Well, we've run out of time, unfortunately. So we'll end it there. But hopefully, when you come back in the fall sometime, we get you back and keep the conversation going, because it's hearing from people like you that has to happen here, and it's not, and it's. The story is very well censored, very well controlled. The complicity of the American media, it's difficult, but we need to keep on keeping on. So
yes, my friend. Yeah. Yes.
So thanks very much, Nadal. Have a great trip, and we'll talk to you when you get back.
Thanks, my friend. It's really great to be here. It's really great talking to you, and hopefully we'll do this more when I get back.
Great. Thanks, Nadal.
You have been listening to our conversation with Nadal Al-Azraq, Executive Director of the organization 1-4-3. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here every week at the same time and place. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. To access our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. This archive was developed and is maintained by our colleague and sound engineer, Stan Robinson. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.